This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, November 11th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In August 2020, after the police shooting of Jacob Blake, civil unrest broke out in Kenosha, Wisconsin. 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse from nearby Antioch, Illinois, went to Kenosha to, he said, protect local businesses. Shortly before midnight on August 25th, in a confrontation with protesters, Rittenhouse shot and killed two people, 36-year-old Joseph Rosenbaum and 26-year-old Anthony Huber, and wounded a third. Rittenhouse's actions ignited a political firestorm. Some blamed the shootings on Trump-backed fear-mongering about the threat posed by progressive groups like Black Lives Matter. Others saw Rittenhouse as a young man who exercised his constitutional rights to defend himself. In the years since, he has become an obsessive topic of conversation for pundits on the left and the right. Rittenhouse is currently standing trial in Kenosha. The judge in the case, Bruce Schroeder, spoke last week about the challenges of trying a case in such a politically charged atmosphere.
There was a gentleman on TV night before last who said this is the most divisive case in the country today. So anything that undermines public confidence in what happens here is very important. It's important for this town. It's important for this country to have people have confidence in the result of this trial, whatever it is. And I don't care what it is.
Paige Williams, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the Rittenhouse case and what the trial tells us about the current intersection of politics and justice. Hi, Paige. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We are talking on Wednesday afternoon. You've been following the trial, which is also being streamed online. On Tuesday, the prosecution rested its case after calling 22 witnesses in 6 days. So maybe first tell us about the prosecution's approach as of the end of the day Tuesday.
The prosecution has tried to make a case that the defendants state of mind played a part in what happened that night. There were a lot of people, as we know from the voluminous reporting that has surrounded this case, that there were a lot of various factions on the ground that night, a lot of them with concealed handguns, a lot of them with open carrying long guns. And they've tried to lay out a case that the very presence of guns ratcheted up the tension that night in Kenosha. The most intense day of the trial was a week ago today when the jury was shown video footage of the three shootings, the death of Joseph Rosenbaum, the death of Anthony Huber, and the shooting of Gage Grosskreutz.
And then tell us a little bit more about what was going on in the courtroom today, especially the testimony of Rittenhouse himself.
Yeah, today was incredibly dramatic because Rittenhouse had been on the stand for only a few minutes when his attorney, Mark Richards, the lead counsel in the case for the defense, asked him about the moments leading up to the first shooting, Joseph Rosenbaum's shooting. And Rittenhouse had a very emotional reaction to the questions. He sobbed, he heaved, he seemingly couldn't get his breath, and the judge had to call a break for Rittenhouse to regain his composure, which he did do after they returned. Online, it was interesting to watch people's various reactions to this, especially on Twitter. You know, there were some people who felt that that was an overly dramatic response and an authentic response to the questions. And then others were like, you know, poor kid, this was a traumatic event, and he's now reliving it.
So some details about the Rittenhouse shootings are still up for debate, but the essential facts about what happened on the night of August 25th, 2020, are pretty clear. Could you just remind us, for people who haven't been following this day by day, remind us what happened?
Yeah, this is not a case that you want to shorthand because it is so extraordinarily, it's going to sound contradictory to say this, but I'll say it anyway. This case is inextricable from hyperpartisan politics, yet it's very straightforward as a matter of law because the defendant is claiming self-defense. And in Wisconsin, he need only prove that he feared for his life or for great bodily harm at the moment that he pulled the trigger. So on the night of the 25th, as I say, it's dangerous to shorthand this one, but I will try. Yes. This was the third night of protests following the shooting of Jacob Blake. The demonstrations in Kenosha had been violent. There were peaceful demonstrations, and then there was an element that was lighting fires, it was breaking into businesses, it was causing millions of dollars worth of damage to the city. And this had prompted people from outside the community and inside the community to decide that the police and firefighters could not handle this escalation on their own. So they armed themselves and went into Kenosha to defend businesses. Now, Rittenhouse and a group, a handful of other men and one woman were guarding this business called Car Source. They, for most of the night, were standing around outside the mechanic shop of this business, but some of the guys were on the roof. And this presented to some of the demonstrators who were being pushed down past them by the police. They felt menaced by it. Things got a little heated when some rioters started setting things on fire near that business, and some words were exchanged. Rittenhouse went to put out a fire nearby, got separated from his group, wound up a couple blocks away being chased by Rosenbaum into another Car Source parking lot. A bystander who had been sort of hanging out with Rosenbaum. I think you wouldn't call him a bystander. I think that everyone stipulates that he was a demonstrator and was armed, and that he, as Rosenbaum chased Rittenhouse, raised his gun up at an angle and fired one warning shot. And at that point, Rittenhouse whirled around. Rosenbaum was appearing to lunge at him, and Rittenhouse fired, and Rosenbaum was hit four times and died moments later. Rittenhouse testified that just after shooting Rosenbaum, that he was surrounded by people who he thought were going to do him harm. So he fled the parking lot. He left to go turn himself into the police. As he was running toward the police, a man ran up behind him and struck him in the head with a rock. Anthony Huber hit him with his skateboard, with the edge of his skateboard. Rittenhouse, by that point, was on the ground and in what he calls a defensive position. And when Huber tried to reach for the barrel of his rifle, Rittenhouse fired. Grosskreutz, who had his hands up at one point, then pointed, Rittenhouse testified, the pistol at him, and he fired on him and hit him in the arm. It took his bicep off. And he jumped up again, Rittenhouse did, and went back toward the police. And
did he have his rifle still at that point?
Yeah, he did. He wasn't holding it. It was attached to him by a sling, a single point sling, which means that oftentimes people wear these slings so that the rifle can't be taken from them. He was not pointing it at that point or even holding it, I don't think. It was just sort of dangling at his hip level.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You wrote for The New Yorker in July about how political opportunism sort of shaped the public's understanding of the Rittenhouse shootings. And maybe you could talk a little bit more about how the story has been driven by narratives framed by the left and by the right, I mean, in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it started immediately. I think I when I was trying to do the timeline of all of this, to me, it looked like the first bits went out on social media like 12 minutes after the shooting. So immediately people began to frame this in terms of who had the right to be there, who didn't have the right to be there, who is the hero, who is the villain, who is the patriot, who are the interlopers. And just to be really reductive about it, the left immediately, including high-profile figures on the left, immediately assumed Rittenhouse to be a white supremacist who had come to Kenosha to do harm and to hurt people. He was there because he considered himself someone with first aid experience. He did not go to hurt people, or much less to kill people. On the right, the immediate claim was that he was doing what every American, had a right to do, to defend their own communities. And this, this goes back. Luke Mogelson did the most excellent reporting for us even before this point. Like, he laid this out as people are arming themselves because they feel driven to do so, because they feel like Democratic-run cities have surrendered their authority to impose law and order, and that citizens had no choice but to defend their towns for themselves. So that was the nature of the polarization. People thought that Rittenhouse was a patriot and an exemplary American for going there in the first place, and others said and still say he had no business being there.
What exactly are the jurors going to have to rule on?
The charges involve and include the most serious crimes in Wisconsin, including intentional homicide. The judge has not given the jury instructions on what they must rule on and or consider. So I don't want to speak to that. From my understanding, under Wisconsin law, they will, in those charges, need to consider whether it was reasonable at the moment that Rittenhouse fired his gun that any reasonable person would have feared for his life or for great bodily harm and defended himself in that moment.
And he was legally carrying an assault rifle.
Well, now that gets into a whole other question. He was not legally old enough. He was 17 at the time of these shootings. He's not legally old enough to buy it, but the defense is trying to make the case that he was legally old enough to possess it. And the prosecution is trying to say, that's not going to work. But we've not heard that part of the case yet. So it's going to be interesting to hear the judge talk about what the jury must consider when they're thinking about this. Now, people on both sides of this were armed. There were people, Pat Moretti, one of the Kenosha police officers who testified last week, said that there were more people armed that night than not.
Whatever the verdict, assuming there is not a mistrial, one side will obviously claim vindication. The other will write furious tweets and op-eds. What, though, could change depending on the outcome? What's really at stake in the trial, aside from the political points everyone's trying to make?
What a good question. I can't see into the future, but people have framed this as a pivotal case involving the Second Amendment. And there are some who believe that an acquittal would lead to increased vigilantism, that people would feel emboldened to go anywhere and everywhere they want with guns, to do whatever, quote-unquote, safeguarding or monitoring or patrolling of communities that they and their subjective judgment feels not being handled by the police. And then on the other side, you know, a conviction, the far right would certainly say that their Second Amendment rights are being infringed on by leftists. Judge Schrader has said this is not a Second Amendment case. This has nothing to do with the politics of the day. This has to do with whether the defendant felt he was in jeopardy when he pulled the trigger. Therefore, it's a self-defense case. It's not a second. It's everyone else who has made this into. It's the polarized partisan politics that have hijacked this into a Second Amendment case.
Thank you so much, Paige.
It's my pleasure.
Paige Williams is a staff writer at The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.